Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
Well, hey there, everybody. I am Andrew Langer in for Tony Katz today. On Tony Katz today, I am a radio and talk show host, also the director of the Center for Regulatory Freedom at the CPAC Foundation. You know, the folks who put up the big CPAC conference in Washington, D.C. every year. I do regulatory policy for them. And this is important stuff. You know, we had a conversation with Phil Kirpin in the first hour, Phil Kirpin from American Commitment, about regulatory issues. And this, again, and context, right? We're talking about the context of that college student whose graduation has now been canceled because of the entitled little jerks who are protesting to free Palestine as though Palestine were a thing that needed to be freed. So, you know, the context, oh my goodness, I just where to start with this. So we got the economics numbers yesterday. And they were, I think, unsurprising. If you're looking around at what's going on in the world, the lackluster economics numbers should be unsurprising. Of course, the White House won't believe them. In fact, Carl, let's go ahead and play cut number six. Here's Corinne Jean-Pierre on Air Force One heading to New York yesterday.
The economy is slowing. The expectation was it was going to be 2.5% in the first quarter, and it was 1.6%. And we saw the statement from the president talking about how it's been 3% over the last year, but was 1.6 about what the White House had projected.
So look, you saw this in the statement, so I'm just going to reiterate just a little bit here what the GDP report showed. The economy remains strong, and we've been talking about the steady and stable growth, and that's what we see from that report today.
I mean, that is a lie on the level of any kind of propaganda that Leni Riefenstahl put out for the Third Reich in Germany during World War II. The economy is stable and strong. Hey, guess what? I'm sorry. I'm yelling into the microphone. I've got to moderate my voice, my anger here. Guess what? If your GDP is performing 33% below expectations and is below 2%. First of all, that's neither stable nor strong. Well, I'll tell you what is stable and strong. The inflation rate seems to be stable and strong. Stable in terms of it, it's going up at a stable and steady clip. But context is everything. And the reality is that this is the end result of this Biden administration policy. And I know we spend a lot of time talking about spending, but I got to talk about the regulatory side of it because this is my bread and butter. There's a great piece out. In fact, I want to pull this up. There is a great piece out by Steve Moore, Phil Kirpin's colleague at American Commitment. There's a chart that he put up yesterday. I guess it comes from the American Action Forum yesterday about regulatory activity to April 19th in year four and the cost. You know, the number of rules and the cost. Now, you know, final rules is a bit of a misnomer because when the Trump administration rolled back regulations, they had to go through the regulatory process. So it looks like there were more final rules between inauguration day and April 19th of year four of the administration under Biden than Trump. But it's the substance of those rules that matters. Now Phil Kirpin sort of dismissed this and said, well, this is just the administration's numbers. Still, this is a good solid number to use. By the same time, right, in terms of regulatory costs, what it costs the American economy, the Biden administration, $1.37 trillion in new regulatory costs added between Inauguration Day and April 19th of 2024. The Trump administration, $30.1 billion. You know, that is, listen, you don't do math on the air. I'm not going to do math on the air to calculate the percentage of what that is. But as I've long said, regulatory costs remain stable between, you know, essentially while Donald Trump was president. I want to say within 2% increase in regulatory costs. You know, when we're talking about, couple of $1 trillion there that he inherited from the Biden, from the Obama administration, because the Obama administration essentially doubled regulatory costs, went from $1.2 trillion a year to $2.4 trillion a year in the 8 years of the Obama administration. And now the Biden administration has added $1.3 trillion. So when you're keeping it down to about $30 billion a year, that's pretty darn good. Or $30 billion over the course of 3.25 years. That's pretty darn good. That is a steady and stable, as it were. Yeah, I know we're talking about Washington, D.C. numbers, a billion here and a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. The point is, regulations are a drag on the American economy. That's the nature of it. By the way, it's why the Biden administration has stopped as a rule. And when I say a rule, I mean literally a presidential executive order that was issued last year says that they no longer have to account for the regulatory costs. All they have to do is talk about the benefits. That they don't want to admit to these things, which makes it much, much harder for those of us who are in the business of trying to figure these things out. The point in the end is that at their core, the concept of an economic regulation that's supposed to abate some kind of public harm is that they raise the cost of doing the wrong thing such that it makes more financial sense for somebody to do the right thing. It's a carrot and stick approach to these situations. But the problem is, and this is the other side of this, is that there's an opportunity cost that is involved. I mentioned this to Phil, and I mentioned this earlier on. So a really great study that was done about a decade ago by a pair of economists from Appalachian State and North Carolina State University, Dawson and Cedar. And essentially the conclusion was that for every dollar in direct regulatory costs, there's a $19 multiplier in lost opportunity cost. So, you know, if you are a business owner and you want to, let's say, hire more people and increase the productive nature of your business so you can get more revenue that way, well, if you have to spend that money, instead of hiring people, you have to spend it on a new pizza oven because of a new EPA mandate out there. Or all of a sudden you're having to pay higher electricity prices because you can't use natural gas to heat your home or cook your food. That's money you can't spend elsewhere. There's a lost opportunity cost. And so that's what we're talking about in terms of opportunity cost. It's somebody making the choice for you, so that you can't do the thing that you might otherwise want to do. And so a $1.3 trillion increase in direct regulatory costs translates into about $25 trillion in lost opportunity cost. And isn't it interesting that that's just about the same size as our national debt? Now, listen, I'm not saying that we need to exist in a zero regulation environment. Nobody is saying that. We all want clean air and clean water, but we have to make a choice as citizens as to how far we want to go. The question that was raised, I participated in a study 25 years ago, almost 30 years ago, a reinventing the EPA project, where one of the questions that was asked was, how clean is clean? Because we know it costs X number of dollars to, let's say, get 80% of an environmental problem solved. It costs, let's say, 10 times that X to get the next 10% done because of the, you know, what you need to do. And then it costs, let's say, 100 times to get to a zero exposure level. So we have to ask ourselves, right? There's no great mystery here in terms of the relationship between the great environmental regulations of the 1970s, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act, and the collapse of American industry in the late 1970s and into the 1980s. That's the trade-off. And so we have to ask ourselves, well, if we want to solve these financial problems, these budgetary problems, robbing Peter to pay Paul while accruing ever greater amounts of debt and having to pay service on that debt. Maybe just maybe we ought to unleash the economic engine and recognize that growing the American regulatory state by $1.3 trillion has an impact on the American economy. Maybe that's part of what makes us go down and drop down to 1.6% GDP in the first quarter. Down almost a third from where expectations were, and down almost half by where we were the average the year before. Oh, and at the same time, the Biden administration is ramping up the regulatory tempo in anticipation of possibly not getting reelected. These things matter, ladies and gentlemen. It's not done in a vacuum, and context is everything. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Jim Pinkerton. I'm Andrew Langer. This is Tony Katz Today. You've seen him on Fox News. My dad loves this guy. Loves this guy. By the way, the same way my dad loves Tony Katz, my dad is a huge, huge Tony Katz fan. But the gentleman who's coming on is Jim Pinkerton. He's been on Fox News. He's worked for White House. He's done a bunch of different things. But he's the author of a new book. It's called The Secret of Directional Investing, How to Make Money Amidst the Red, Blue Rumble. And Jim, you know, listen, we've been talking about these economics numbers, new report out from the American Action Forum about regulation and $1.3 trillion added to regulatory costs in America. I want to get your thoughts about the relationship between regulations and the economy and where things stand right now.
Well, I mean, the Biden administration is certainly trying to regulate certain industries to death. It came in back in 2021 aiming at the carbon fossil fuel industry, and then gas prices started rising, unsurprisingly, and so they backed off when they sort of back and forth, and just the other day they had some regulations on Alaska, trying to shut down energy in Alaska, and before that they had the liquid natural gas pause, and of course the result is completely predictable, which is energy prices rise, which is, actually bad for the Biden reelection campaign, but the Biden administration has to sort that out within itself as to whether it's more important for Biden to get reelected or to fight climate change. They haven't quite figured that out.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I asked this question with regards to the war in Ukraine, and the surest way to beat the Russians would seem to be to bankrupt the Russian oil economy. But they seem to think that fighting climate change is so important, so hamstringing America's energy sector is out there. But let's set that aside for a second, Jim, because I want to talk about the book. The book is, hold on, I got it here, The Secret of Directional Investing, How to Make Money Amidst the Red, Blue Rumble. I mean, this is what you're talking about here in these times of economic push pull and the back and forth between red and blue. What is the secret to directional investing? Not that you need to give away the whole book.
The secret is to just observe trends and which direction they're going in, hence the title. So for example, Walt Disney used to be a strong national brand. And then they went woke, and they kind of wrecked the Star Wars franchise, for example. And now the stock is down 40% in the last 3 years. And so anybody who was holding Disney, including tons of pension funds and so on, has lost a lot of money. Conversely, if you've seen the trend and said, look, this company has gone woke, and they just brought back this guy Bob Iger, who was a big liberal hero, and so I'm going to short the stock, which is to say bet it goes down, you can make just as much money as an investor if you bet right on shorting the stock as if it goes up. And so you would have seen the opportunity there. And you can now look at other brands, too, and that are national brands. And, I'm talking about, Target and, Bud Light. And also, to take one of the biggest, the investment house BlackRock, which I bet a lot of people have money in, even if they don't know it. BlackRock is, $10 trillion in assets. And yet, in the last few years, they've just chosen to go sort of woke and green and ESG, and now they're getting hurt. States like Texas and Florida and Arkansas are withdrawing their money from the pension funds there and it's hurting stock. And so I think one can look ahead and see, all right, if BlackRock becomes BlueRock, as in sort of Democratic, what opportunity then is there for sort of a counter investment house, a red rock, if you will, coming out of, you know, the Sun Belt somewhere or some red state? I think that's a great, I think you're already seeing that as investment figures like Carl Icahn and Ken Griffin move from New York and Illinois, respectively, both to Florida.
You know, I had this conversation with someone in the financial services world a couple of weeks back, talking about the issue of subjective metrics being put on these large corporations, you know, DEI, ESG, et cetera. And she pushed back and was like, oh, no, you know, there's a way to do this. But really, right, Jim, when we talk about free markets, when we had Phil on earlier and a couple others on earlier, you know, the whole idea is the goal of the corporation, the company, is supposed to maximize shareholder investments, to maximize profits for the shareholders. When you intersperse that with politics, you're gonna wind up losing money. And in that case, what they have to do is they have to change the rules of the game. Folks have to pay attention to what's going on in government policies in terms of changing the rules that hamstring everybody, don't they?
Well, that's certainly true that new regulations create inefficiencies. However, and this is an important point for investors, as distinct from, you know, free market pundits, if a given political policy, a state, for example, our country, makes the choice, we want to make these investments work, they can work. I mean, the United States has, rightly or wrongly, put $20 trillion, with a T, dollars into green energy in the last quarter century. You know, that much money guarantees you're going to, as an investor, if you're just conscious of making money, which is frankly, what the book's about, you will do fine if Uncle Sam is your partner in Tesla or, you know, Al Gore or any of these things. It's an observation that if a country, a state, or a government of some kind is willing to put in the money, including somebody else's money, into an investment, it can do well. And sometimes, of course, you know, investments just take off. I mean, for example, you know, AI is so huge that even California, which from a conservative free market point of view, kind of does everything wrong in terms of the way the government operates. And yet, if NVIDIA goes from zero to $1 trillion in 15 years, you're still making money. And if this, you know, NVIDIA is as good a stock as it is in the century, it's gone up 500% in the last 3 years.
Yeah, you got to pay attention to the trends in terms of where things are going, but also what might be around the corner. We're talking with Jim Pinkerton. The Secret of Directional Investing is his book, How to Make Money Amidst the Red Blue Rumble. Jim, you've been involved in politics for a really long time. You don't see the rumble getting any better in the near term, do you?
I see it continuing. I see, you know, media polarization occurring, but I also see opportunities. I had a piece in Center Square just the other day making the point that, you know, as we think about the rise of AI and NVIDIA and Microsoft and OpenAI and all these, you know, giant billion, now soon to be trillion-dollar, you know, companies on AI, the one thing that's notable about them is how energy hungry they are. I mean, for example, a search on ChatGPT takes 60 times as much energy as a Google search. So these AI companies, you know, they're all cool and everything, but they can't possibly run without enormous energy. And so we can't make the mistake that they made in Germany, for example. They think you can run all this with, you know, wind and solar. So that actually bodes well for oil and gas and maybe even coal. I mean, it, you know, NVIDIA is up 500%, as I said. Exxon is up more than 200%. I mean, you know, wow. There's more than one investment to be made here, including energy as the obvious companion to AI.
Here, here. Hey, Jim, we got to let it go there. I appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Jim Pinkerton. The book is The Secret of Directional Investing, How to Make Money Amidst the Red-Blue Rumble. It's not out yet. Pre-orders are out there. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, et cetera. Go and check it out there. Listen, we're going to continue to talk about economics issues. We're going to talk about the bedrock principles of intellectual property and how that undergirds and what the Biden administration is doing right now. Going to be joined by a really interesting guest in a minute, someone you might not readily hear on Tony Katz Today or one of my other shows. We're going to talk to President Obama's Patent and Trademark Office Director. I am Andrew Langer. I am sitting in for Tony Katz. Oh, and we got all kinds of things to talk about later on. This is Tony Katz Today. Back. I am Andrew Langer in for Tony Katz Today. On Tony Katz Today, very excited to bring our guest on. His name is David Kappos. He is with an organization called the Council for Innovation Promotion. He's a partner, the head of the IT section at Cravath, Swain & Moore, which is a storied law firm based in New York City. He's also, as I mentioned earlier, he was President Obama's Patent and Trademark Office Director. David, listen, let's jump right into it here. I had a long conversation with colleagues yesterday about this issue of buy, dole, and intellectual property. Let's start by, because I don't think I've talked to folks on this show about it. Talk a little bit about buy, dole, briefly about it, and what it means to innovation.
Yeah, sure, Andrew, and thanks for having me on this afternoon. So
always.
The Buy-Dole Act goes back to around 1980. It was a bipartisan piece of legislation, Birch Bayh and Bob Dole, DNR, and it enabled universities especially and small businesses and other companies getting companies and institutions getting federal funding to retain control of the patents that related to that federal funding. And while I'm sure, Andrew, to listeners, that sounds a little gorpy, it had an absolutely transformative effect on the commercialization of government-funded R&D in our country, because once companies and universities could keep the patents that they created using federal funding, they had every incentive to invest vastly more money of their own in order to develop products and services and put them in the marketplace. So Buy-Dole worked extraordinarily well.
And so it's worked extraordinarily well. We all, not we all, many of us agree that it's had this profound effect. And yet now there are folks pushing the Biden administration to change it. Why?
Yeah, so it's crazy. The why is, you know, it's about election year politics and purporting to help relative to drug prices. Now everybody cares about drug prices, and we all want drugs to be affordable, but it's got absolutely nothing to do with the Buy-Dole Act. And so, unfortunately, the reason given is inapplicable, and worse yet, overturning the Buy-Dole Act, which is essentially what's proposed, will have disastrous effects for R&D transfer, like I was saying, making products and services out of government-funded R&D.
But let's, you know, it's interesting. Let's talk about this, because there is... I've written about this. You've written about this. You and I have both spoken about this and done media on this, about this issue, about the underlying Buy-Dole Act, that you know, government has the power to march in and take these patents if they lie fallow, if they're not being used. And we get that, right? We get that if somebody, you know, is taking government money and they've discovered something that somebody else thinks is important, they don't want to do anything with it. Okay, well, we give government this power to do this. So you and I both talked about the issue that this march-in, that's what it's called, the march-in provision, can't be used to for the justification of prices. But the folks who are pushing this have said, well, the legislative history says this, and there is this the reasonable relationship. I don't remember what the verbiage is, but talk about the how the legislative history and the interpretation is being misstated by the folks who are pushing for this.
Yeah, it really is, Andrew. So the Buy-Dole Act from the beginning was expressly not meant as an excuse or a vehicle for the government to regulate prices. We all know that's a terrible idea. In our country, the market sets prices. The government does not set prices. And the legislative history indeed demonstrates that, with discussion at the time the legislation was passed, with the express exclusion of any mention of prices as a basis to march in. There were four bases that were given in the legislation to march in. Price was not among them. And then later statements, years later, by Bayh and Dole, confirming that indeed the Buy-Dole Act expressly did not intend to provide the government any basis to march in on the base of setting prices.
All right, and it was almost 20 years after the act was passed that there was an obscure law review article that was put out in which it advanced this theory, written by a lawyer and an epidemiologist, and then somebody decided to challenge this in 2004, petitioned the government and lost. And I guess my point is, they the forces that have been trying to do this have been at this for 25 years now, so more than half the life, let's say 20 years, so half of the life of the act, and yet now they have this opportunity. What happens if they succeed? What happens to research and development investment in America at these major research universities?
Well, I think it tumbles. What happens, Andrew, is what's already happening. Companies, universities, research institutions that otherwise would be applying for federal grant money are asking their advisors, including their lawyers, is any IP that I create with federal funding going to be contaminated? And that's the word they're using, contaminated. That's, in fact, the same word that was used to describe government-funded innovation before the Buy-Dole Act existed. It was considered contaminated. And if that word sounds derogatory, it's absolutely
meant to be. Yeah.
And I think we're going to return to that world in which funding sources, whether they be companies, venture funders, private equity, whatever, are going to run headlong from government-funded R&D because they're going to be concerned that, heaven forbid, a successful product should be created based in part on that government-funded R&D. Because if a successful product is created, of course, some other company is going to petition to march in based on the fact that they're a bigger company, there always is one, or a foreign company in somewhere like China that's got a huge labor advantage and right, that they can make the product less expensively. So expect every significant product that comes from federal funding to get a petition on it based on price, and expect the government to get into the business of pricing products.
Now, real quick, David, we're talking with David Kappos. He's with the Council for Innovation Promotion Partner, Cravath, Swain & Moore. The issue, we've been talking a little bit about colleges and the craziness that's going on college campuses right now, but we can all agree that colleges, they need to find ways to save money or make money, right? We talk about this. Colleges, especially smaller colleges and historically black colleges and universities, they make huge amounts of money. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, they are able to backfill their costs. They're able to bring in revenue because of this. What happens to those institutions if these folks succeed at this?
Yeah. So another great point, Andrew. So, yeah, in fact, what happens now under the Buy-Dole Act is colleges and universities bring in literally billions, many billions of dollars a year, licensing the patents that they create using federal funding. They license those patents to companies that commercialize the innovation. Everybody wins. The American people win because they get new products and services, and that's how America leads the world. The universities win, which is your point, because they get literally billions of dollars of funding. What do they do with that funding? Of course, they invest it in more R&D. So it's a virtuous cycle that we currently have. And this has been the magic of the Buy-Dole Act. The money gets fed back into R&D. You get more great innovation coming from universities, more products and services, all thanks to the Buy-Dole Act. And all that's going to go, I believe it's all going to go out the window. We're going to see it all reversed.
Well, David, how do folks find out about the good work the Council for Innovation Promotion is doing?
Yeah, so you can find our website. This is a bipartisan nonprofit, so it's all about just calling balls and strikes. And you can find our website, C4IP, Council for Innovation Promotion, C4IP.org. And you find a lot of information there, Andrew, about the Bayh-Dole Act, positions on the Bayh-Dole Act, why it has been such a brilliant piece of legislation, and why it is not a good idea for the federal government to overturn it.
Here, here. David, listen, I thank you for the work that you're doing. And listen, I know you're back in your new offices next week, so take care.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
Hey, thanks. That was David Kappos, Council for Innovation Promotion, President Obama's director of his patent and trademark office, now a partner in the intellectual practice of Cravath, Swin & Moore. Listen, we want to note the untimely passing of a rock star and talk about the idiocy of our NASA administrator. I'm Andrew Langer. This is Tony Katz Today.
We've already said
that just sits here and makes me smile a little bit. I get a little teary at this. So that's an early hit by the Moody Blues called Go Now. And it's not a psychedelic song, right? I mean, obviously, you know, folks remember the Moody Blues, Nights in White Satin, Tuesday Afternoon, The Question, et cetera, all the stuff from their later years. But you know, in 1965, they were a good, solid, you know, concert rock band. And the reason why I played that song, I love it, loved it for years, is the keyboard player, the piano player on that tune is a guy named Mike Pinder. Mike was the original keyboardist with the Moody Blues, and he passed away yesterday, I think it was. And the Moody Blues has lost a couple of members. Listen, I sit here and I contemplate this, and it just astounds me that we keep losing rock musicians right and left, and yet Keith Richards still stands. It's the line from Wayne's World 2, right? Keith can only be killed without Keith cannot be killed by conventional weapons, I think is the line from that movie. Before we go, and I just wanted to throw that in there. One of the things I wanted to talk about this week, as soon as Tony asked me to do the show today, it was something I wanted to bring up. In addition to my love of music and my love of regulation, I'm a space nut. I've been interested in space travel and space flight since I was a kid. I'm a huge fan of the TV series, if you've never seen it, From the Earth to the Moon. And I'm very interested in us returning to space and not ceding space to other nations, especially China. And so I get dismayed when I hear folks in power talking essentially out of their posteriors about things. The administrator of NASA, former U.S. Senator from Florida, Bill Nelson, was testifying up on Capitol Hill earlier this week. Here's what he had to say. Let's play cut number 11.
And we're trying to get at what the Chinese are doing, you think, on the backside of the moon. Do you have any insights in that?
They are going to have a lander on the far side of the moon, which is the side that's always in dark. We're not planning to go there.
And why not? And what's the benefit of doing so?
We don't know what's on the backside of the moon, so that would be something that they would discover. But our decision is that it's more profitable for us to go to the South Pole.
Oh, my God.
Because we think that's where the water is.
We could stop it there. I mean, it's like, because it gets into the weeds. But the bottom line is the NASA administrator is fundamentally wrong. The NASA administrator, the person who is essentially in charge of directing our return to the moon and are taking further steps into outer space, says that, well, we don't know what's on the far side of the moon because it's dark. I mean, that's in line with Hank Johnson asking somebody if Guam was going to tip over if too many people were on it. That's the kind of idiocy we have. And it's so astoundingly ignorant. Yes, Hey, we do know what's on the dark side of the moon, or the far side of the moon. How do we know this? Because we've flown around it many, many times, and we've taken pictures. Now, you know, the moon is not always, you know, it's the far side of the moon is not always in darkness. What we're talking about here is the fact that, oh, I'll get into orbital mechanics here. I'll get into a little bit into the weeds. The way that the moon rotates, the way it spins around, and then its orbit around the Earth is such that the same side is always pointed towards the Earth. But that side is not always getting sunlight or light, right? Because of, again, the phases of the moon and the way, oh, my God, it is pointed vis-a-vis the sun. So the far side of the moon is not always dark. We have flown around it. We have taken pictures of it. We've been around the moon a number of times, not only when we landed on the moon, but other flybys around the moon. We've got maps there. But is it any wonder? Is it any wonder that we are losing ground in space? I know that's a mixed metaphor. Let's recalibrate. I know that we are losing. Is it any wonder that we are losing distance in space when we have idiots like this running our space program? I mean, listen, I guess in comparing to President Biden, Bill Nelson is a genius. It literally, I mean, it's like somebody woke up and started handing out stupid pills in Washington, D.C. to try to make the president of the United States look smarter. Well, here's a stupid pill for you, Bill Nelson. You go out and you pontificate about the far side of the moon being dark all the time. Oh, sorry. I did, you know, to end on that kind of a note, but I've had that in my head for the last couple of days here. Listen, I hope you've enjoyed what you've been hearing, especially folks who are relatively new to Tony Katz Today. I am Andrew Langer. You can find me. I host three podcasts, The Lunch Hour with Federal Newswire, wherever fine podcasts are found. This week, I interview Chuck DeVore from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Andrew and Jerry Save the World, we're going to have a new episode out next week. And also Swamp Secrets, Exposing Regulatory Dark Matter. Thanks for tuning in at Andrew_Langer on Twitter. Have fun, everybody. Stay safe.